Hi, I'm Tyler Foggett. Join me and my colleagues as we go beyond the headlines and deepen your understanding of the forces shaping our world today on The Political Scene, a newly updated podcast from The New Yorker. With episodes three times each week, The Political Scene accesses the sharpest minds in politics for insight and analysis about everything from abortion rights to the war in Ukraine. Make sure you're following The Political Scene, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It may not kill you, but dengue fever can make you very sick, and it's spreading like wildfire across Brazil.
Smaller cities, more remote cities that usually don't have so much dengue transmission are now having.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. In another part of Latin America, people have already seen what happens when the government bans IVF.
This was a quarter of a century before the Alabama Supreme Court did the same thing.
Also today, camel racing on the Arabian Peninsula, and tourists arriving in Greenland on cruise ships will need to pay a new green tax.
Plus, the challenges of cleaning up an oil spill in the Caribbean.
What happens in the marine environment doesn't stay where it started. It affects all the other territories.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here today. Right now in Brazil, there is a major outbreak of dengue fever. The mosquito-borne disease is common in the tropics. It's rarely fatal, but...
I felt a lot of pain in my eyes, back and legs, a lot of weakness and tiredness.
It's a lot of fever, a lot of muscle pain.
I literally couldn't do anything for at least a couple of weeks.
It wears you down and it can last at least a couple of weeks. As these people who've had dengue told us, it can make you really sick.
The World's Tibisa Isaiah reports that the dengue epidemic in Brazil might be spreading across the Americas and could show up here in the United States this summer.
It's one of the largest dengue outbreaks ever seen in Brazil, a country of over 200 million people. Brazil's health minister, Nícia Trindade, addressed Brazilians earlier this month.
Agora é hora de todo o Brasil se unir contra a dengue.
Now is the time for all Brazilians to be united against dengue, she said. She urged people to check their homes and get rid of any stagnant water where mosquitoes lay their eggs. So far this year, Brazil has recorded over 800,000 dengue cases, four times more than during the same period last year.
And is in a track to break all records of transmissions.
Ernesto Marquez is a dengue researcher at the University of Pittsburgh.
Smaller cities, more remote cities that usually don't have so much dengue transmission are now having.
He says dengue cases usually surge and fall in cycles. 2024 was already expected to be a bad dengue year for Brazil, but the problem got worse because of climate factors. The weather phenomenon El Niño, which causes a lot of rain, is currently affecting the region.
O calor recorde e as chuvas acima da média desde o ano passado.
Minister Trindade said high temperatures and above average rain helped mosquitoes reproduce. People living in densely populated cities are especially vulnerable. The city of Rio de Janeiro, one of the most populous in Brazil, is under a health emergency.
A epidemia de dengue no Rio é muito séria. A gente tem um aumento de número de casos.
Rio's Secretary of Health, Daniel Sorans, told me that the situation got even worse after recent carnival celebrations, which attracted millions of visitors. Last year, Brazil regulators approved a dengue vaccine developed by a Japanese company. But distribution started late and there's not enough of the vaccine, says Albert Koh, a professor of public health and an expert on dengue at Yale University.
There are only roughly 7 million or so doses at this point. And the number of people who are at risk of getting dengue and who could potentially benefit from the vaccine is many times or many fold greater than that.
The dengue epidemic is not exclusive to Brazil. Peru declared a dengue health emergency yesterday, and Argentina, Paraguay, and Colombia are also reporting large numbers of cases.
And it's not uncommon that you have a sentinel event, like such as a large epidemic in Brazil, and have that similar experience in other countries in South America.
He says as the summer switches from the southern to the northern hemisphere, so does dengue.
And because of travel between hemispheres, we will likely see a similar phenomenon happening in Central America and Mexico. And of course, among travelers from the United States who go and visit places in the southern hemisphere.
This mosquito is also establishing in new parts of the world that until recently were free of dengue. There's been reported cases of the disease in France, Italy, and Spain. And in the United States, the population of mosquitoes that transmit dengue has increased in Florida, California, and Arizona. Nili Kamalagive is the head of the Global Dengue Program at the Drugs for Neglected Disease Initiative.
High-income countries are not safe from dengue anymore because of this climate change, and also because of more intense transmission in dengue endemic countries. So it's everybody's problem.
She says the worsening situation in Brazil is a sign of what's to come elsewhere. For the World, I'm Tibisay Sea.
An oil spill near Trinidad and Tobago has spread hundreds of miles. It's now approaching the island of Bonaire. Trinidad and Tobago's Coast Guard first spotted the spill earlier this month, tracing it to a capsized barge stuck on a reef just off the coast of Tobago. Judith Gobin is a professor of marine biology at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad. She says so far the spill has also affected Grenada, the tip of Venezuela, and Bonaire.
Everyone's beginning to panic, of course, because as expected, ecosystems like mangroves and we in Trinidad and Tobago were very worried about our coral reefs. This spill has been spreading. We have not actually had any reports of any distressed coastal birds, for example, or any sort of major smothering and die-off of any animals. But I have no doubt we will get reports of this later on.
Mm. The economy in Trinidad and Tobago, of course, is reliant on tourism. How serious is this oil spill in financial terms, both like the cleanup costs and the potential lost tourist revenue?
So very key question. Trinidad and Tobago, twin island, but the economy is really heavily oil and gas based. Tobago is our paradise island. Tobago is the heart of our tourism. And I'm going to say that it could have been more severely devastating if the spill had continued, let's say, further north and around to where the bigger reef areas are. That would have severely impacted our tourism economy for us. We are very fortunate that it didn't actually venture further north.
Mm. We should note that Trinidad and Tobago, not just an oil and natural gas producer, it is the largest in the Caribbean, save neighboring Venezuela. Wouldn't it be prepared for something like this happening?
As we're an oil and based economy, we actually do have as a country a national oil spill contingency plan that was approved in 2013. And of course, it was designed to mitigate the impact of spills exactly such as this. That is because, of course, we have operators in the inshore as well as the deep offshore areas. So our drilling operators, based on this plan, they would all have equipment, support vessels and so on to deploy and, of course, to have emergency measures in place. So it is a real pity that this plan did not kick into effect immediately. And I think Trinidad and Tobago will need to look at this very, very closely in the next few days.
Mm. So why did that plan not go into action? And what kind of cleanup is going on at this point?
So at the moment, the ministers and the Tobago House of Assembly, they have sprung into action. They're actually working with some cleanup companies. I believe there's a Texas-based company and one in Minnesota. They will be working with local officials to assist with the cleanup and the contamination of the waters and beaches in Tobago. It's a shame because one would think that this is 2024, and given our long-term history and relationship with companies who are operating in first world environments, and they are now operating in our environment, that we would have had a better response and in line with our emergency plan. we have to revise it. We have to look at it. We have to look at the actors, all the emergency responders. How do we get them to spring into action much faster than they actually did this time?
So this barge was being towed and had no one on board. Some initial reports suggest it originated in Panama. What do you know about this barge, and how typical is it to have a barge apparently with no power, just a floating oil storage vessel?
Clearly, there must be something amiss here. I really haven't got a clue, and I think the rest of Trinidad and Tobago were waiting with bated breath to find out. But it is quite a mystery that the barge, which appears to have originated in Panama, being towed by this tugboat, but at the same time, there was no one on the vessel, and there was no distress signal, as far as I'm aware, that was received by the Coast Guard.
As we look at the spill approaching the island of Bonaire, also a place with a heavy reliance on tourism, do you worry about grievances from places that will look at Trinidad and Tobago as a source of the spill?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I keep saying to colleagues, you know, what happens in the marine environment doesn't stay where it started. It affects all the other territories. So it is unfortunate. And, you know, obviously we wish to apologize to these nations and countries and islands close to us. And I have no doubt the government of Trinidad and Tobago will attempt at best to assist in any cleanup operations as needed by Bonaire.
Judith Gobin spoke with us from Trinidad, where she's a professor of marine biology at the University of the West Indies. The Academy Awards are coming up in less than 2 weeks, and we wanted to highlight a couple of musical moments in films that got Oscar nominations. We're talking music here that's noteworthy in our opinion, even if it fell short of being nominated in either the original score or original song categories.
I've come to Parliament and taken an oath to protect the Constitution of Uganda. Somebody had to speak for us. People thought I had the loudest voice.
The film Bobby Wine, The People's President, is up for Best Documentary. It's the story of the Ugandan musician-turned-politician Bobby Wine and the efforts he made at great personal risk to challenge the aging and authoritarian President Yoweri Museveni. Bobby Wine's energetic reggae anthem, Freedom, runs through the film as a kind of mission statement.
What you're doing to this nation? What are you teaching the future generation? See our leaders become misleaders and see our mentors become tormentors.
Another musical highlight this year is found in the much-acclaimed film Poor Things, nominated in the Best Picture category. There's this scene where Emma Stone's character Bella is transfixed by a song. Bella is walking through a neighborhood along the seaport when she hears a woman singing from a balcony. This is the acclaimed Portuguese fado singer Carminho, who stepped into a cameo performance in Poor Things with this number, O Quarto, or The Room. Again, not nominated, but definitely a standout musical moment from this past year. Carminho's song starts with this poignant line, "In this room so small, which I thought was just mine, a poison has infiltrated, which is solitude and me."
Neste quarto tão pequeno, que eu pensava ser só meu, e filtra-se um tal veneno, que a solidão e eu.
Music from the Portuguese fado singer Carminho from the Oscar-nominated film Poor Things. This year's Academy Awards are on Sunday, March 10th.
Juntos não somos todo. É sufocante o fazer. Eu já nem sei. Agora já somos três, mas esses não fazem um, nem ao entrar tu me vês. Este quarto é de nenhum coração que se partiu, que está sem nada para dar.
The phenomenal fado singer Carminho there. Just ahead on the show, the controversial ruling in Alabama that embryos are people is reverberating around the U.S. We look abroad to learn about the fallout from a similar ruling in Costa Rica. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The recent Alabama Supreme Court decision that embryos are people has sparked a debate that sounds familiar to many in Latin America. Costa Rica was the first country in the world to ban in vitro fertilization. In the year 2000, Costa Rica's high court ruled that excess embryos created and discarded in the IVF process have a constitutional right to life. Then, a dozen years later, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights struck down Costa Rica as IVF ban. The new ruling helped usher in an era of reproductive freedom. It was a decision some call the Roe versus Wade of Latin America. For more, we reached out to Lynn Morgan. She's a medical anthropologist focused on Latin America.
In 1995, Costa Rica permitted in vitro fertilization. The Catholic Church was not happy about this decision, and an attorney that was working for the Catholic Bishops' Conference asked the High Court to recognize that the embryos had a right to life. He argued that the embryos that were created through IVF were subject to what he called a disproportionate risk of death and should be protected. And nobody was paying much attention to this at the time, but the Costa Rican Constitutional Court agreed with him. They ruled that human life does begin at conception and that the embryos are therefore protected by a provision in the Costa Rican Constitution that held that human life is inviolable.
Important to note that Costa Rica is Catholic by law.
Costa Rica is a Catholic country within its constitution, but it also guarantees freedom of religion. So this was a quarter of a century before the Alabama Supreme Court did the same thing. The Costa Rican High Court ruled that embryos have full personhood with full legal rights and protections, including fertilized eggs, and including those that are created in the IVF lab and are sitting in a freezer.
So that ban was in effect for a dozen years, and then the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled on the matter, overturning the ban. What did it decide, that court?
That court decided that embryos are not juridical persons and that the rights of embryos may not take precedence over those of women. It said that states do have responsibilities to embryos and fetuses, but that those responsibilities accrue gradually over the course of a pregnancy. And it said the best way to protect the rights of embryos is to protect the rights of pregnant people. It also stated, really importantly, that conception should be defined not as beginning with fertilization, but as beginning when an embryo gets implanted in the womb. So this would exempt IVF embryos. It also said that the IVF ban in Costa Rica violated the rights to privacy, the rights to liberty, the rights to personal integrity, the right to form a family, and the right to be free from discrimination. And it made a big splash throughout the whole hemisphere.
So the Inter-American Court of Human Rights has jurisdiction over many other countries, of course, not just Costa Rica. What were the repercussions of this decision beyond that one country?
Right. So when the Inter-American Court ruled that the IVF ban was a violation of human rights, it ordered Costa Rica to lift the ban and to make the procedure available to everybody. That ruling was considered binding on the 22 countries of the Americas that accept the jurisdiction of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. So what this meant was that it applied not only to people in Costa Rica, but it said that everybody in those 22 countries cannot be barred from having access to in vitro fertilization. But because the court's ruling was so broad in terms of defining that embryos aren't persons, it also had major implications for other reproductive health issues like emergency contraception and stem cell research and abortion. So it was immediately read as a landmark abortion case for Latin America, hence some people calling it the Roe v. Wade of Latin America.
What were those implications? Was it increased access to abortion in Latin American countries?
Yeah, it has led to that. And a lot of people have said that the Inter-American Court ruling was highly influential in the recent decisions to legalize abortion in Argentina, as was done in 2020, in Mexico in 2021, and in Colombia in 2022. So it had major, it has had and continues to have major implications across Latin America, although not in the United States.
Right, because the U.S. never ratified the American Convention on Human Rights, so the ruling isn't binding here.
That's right.
So when Costa Rica's IVF ban was overthrown and that had the impact of increasing access to abortion care in some Latin American countries, that was the opposite of what a lot of folks in Costa Rica would have wanted, right?
Yes, indeed. And that was a major setback for anti-abortion conservatives. They hoped that they could bank on Costa Rica's reputation as a champion of human rights. They hoped to set off a sort of pro-life movement across the Americas. And that's not, in fact, what happened. What happened was quite the opposite.
Hmm. Latin America is still fairly Catholic, and the Vatican officially opposes IVF. Could you tell me how popular IVF is today in Latin America?
IVF is hugely popular in Latin America. The estimates are somewhere between about 200 and 500,000 babies have been born through IVF in Latin America. And a lot of people consider it a gift from God. They don't consider it a violation of Catholic doctrine because it does produce babies.
Hmm. As you mentioned, this is a personal decision for families. When you think about how folks are grappling with issues of reproduction, of faith, is there one maybe conversation you've had in the past that really sticks with you?
When I was doing fieldwork in Costa Rica, I was talking with a father about the controversy over in vitro fertilization. And he said, it's true that only God can make children, and children are a gift from God. He also said that God gave us doctors, and God granted them the knowledge to treat infertility. And shouldn't we respect them and their knowledge also as a gift from God? And I think he was pointing out that not all people, even in people of faith, think that it's a good idea to elevate the rights of embryos above the rights of all the other people that are in God's realm.
Lynn Morgan is a medical anthropologist who focuses on Latin America. Among her many books is Icons of Life, A Cultural History of Human Embryos.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Senegal will hold national elections before the rainy season in July, according to President Macky Sall. But a voting date is still uncertain. Elections were supposed to happen this month until President Sall postponed them. Many saw that as an unconstitutional attempt to extend his term in office.
A very loud sound from a very small fish. That's what researchers in Berlin told the BBC they've discovered. The fish is Danionella cerebrum, and it makes a sound registering 140 decibels, comparable to a gunshot. The scientists say Danionella uses its muscles to essentially drum on a piece of cartilage to produce a sound.
And in Glasgow, a Willy Wonka-themed family event ended in tears and a police intervention. Organizers overpromised with chocolate fountains, audiovisual effects, and dancing Oompa Loompas. But what ticket holders got for $45 was a warehouse with a few plastic props and a small bouncy house. One actor hired to work the event told the Guardian newspaper that he was instructed to give kids a couple of jelly beans and a quarter cup of lemonade at the end.
You're listening to The World.
When fans head to the camel races in the United Arab Emirates, a lot of them don't just take a seat and watch. For many, that is just too boring.
The fact that you have to follow the race and you are not just sitting, you know, and watching. You have to drive your car and watch the road and watch the camels spin.
An evolving tradition on the Arabian Peninsula, ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Greenland gets a lot of visitors who arrive on cruise ships, more than 50,000 of them last year. And that was a 600% jump compared to a decade ago, according to a government-funded travel site. Tourists can be good for the economy, of course, but now Greenland's government is asking tourists for more money, specifically to help preserve the very thing they travel to experience, the environment. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Salih Card says people across Greenland generally welcome tourists. He's a senior advisor in the country's Department of Business and Trade. But some towns simply aren't built to host so many visitors.
The cruise ships are using our facilities very intensively.
Greenland is only home to about 56,000 people, and 20,000 of them live in the capital, Nuuk. So most port towns are small, sparsely populated, and easily overwhelmed by cruise ships with hundreds or even thousands of people deboarding at once.
Unfortunately, we have seen some very popular nature sites where they are ruining the nature, so we have to do something about it.
After a couple of years of public hearings and debates, Greenland introduced two new taxes to keep up with tourism's wear and tear. Starting this year, each cruise ship passenger will pay about $7.25.
Which goes to our government for the maintenance of the harbors.
Plus up to another $7.25 that goes straight to the local municipalities the tourists are visiting.
So some municipalities will spend the money to protect the nature, and in the smaller settlements, they will use the money for having better facilities.
Facilities like public toilets, boardwalks, and signs. There are a number of reasons why more tourists have flocked to Greenland over the past few years in particular, says Karina Wren, who researches Arctic tourism development at Aalborg University in Denmark.
For instance, the geopolitical change, you can say, in like the cruise ecosystem.
Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, many cruise lines have canceled trips to Arctic Russia. Ships are also no longer welcome in Svalbard, which sits between Norway and the North Pole, due to environmental regulations.
And that has meant that a lot of these cruise companies are looking towards Greenland.
Wren says Greenland itself is also promoting tourism for its own purposes.
Greenland is currently a part of the Danish kingdom, but is looking to become independent. And on this quest, they also need to diversify their economy from predominantly being fisheries-based at the moment. So you can say that tourism is also a strategy to work towards independence.
But Wren, who grew up in Greenland, says not everyone is eager to welcome tourists.
There's been recently a discussion of, is it worth it? We have waves of tourists coming in during the summer, more and more, and for longer and longer time. How much do we actually gain from these cruise tourists?
And how much do we lose? Fernando Ugarte leads the Department of Birds and Mammals at the Greenland Institute of Natural Resources.
Narwhals are especially sensitive to boat.
Narwhals, the relatively small whales often called the unicorns of the sea because of their long, straight tusk. Ugarte says his research shows that narwhals are easily disturbed by the sounds of ships in the Greenland fjords where they live.
They stop eating, or they eat less, and they stop their deep dives they do for looking for food. And they were even moving away from the sound, often moving towards shore, close to the land.
Noise pollution from the ships can even cause the animals to flee to the next fjord, which leads to overcrowding and unsafe conditions. Salik Hard from Greenland's Department of Business and Trade says he knows the new taxes won't be able to fix all of the country's tourism-related challenges.
So it would be a contribution.
But Megan Epler-Wood has seen environment taxes make an impact elsewhere around the world. She's the managing director for the Sustainable Tourism Asset Management Program at Cornell. In the Balearic Islands, off the coast of Spain, visitors have for years been paying between $1 and $4 in eco-taxes per person.
They raised $300 million between 2016 and 2021. That's a lot of money.
That money has gone toward improving parks and conserving the ecosystems of native plants and animals. Bali has also started charging foreign visitors a $10 fee to fund sustainable tourism, and Hawaii is currently considering a $25 ecotourism tax. Epler-Wood says determining how the money is spent is important and not always well thought out. Sometimes, she says, the money lands in the wrong hands.
It essentially becomes a political thing where, you know, let's put it towards political agendas.
That's why in Greenland, Salik Hard says getting the tax dollars directly to locals is a pillar of the new strategy. And if the taxes don't do enough to help, Hard says other types of relief are on the table. Greenland is now considering restricting precisely where cruise ships can travel within a few years. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Speaking of cruises, a luxury ship that's been quarantined near Mauritius in the Indian Ocean was finally allowed to dock today. The Norwegian Dawn had been held offshore near the island because a cholera outbreak was suspected among the passengers. More than 3,000 people were on board, and 15 of them had stomach-related illnesses. The Ports Authority prevented the ship from docking to avoid any health risks to people on Mauritius, and it sent health officials to test the food on board as well as the ship's wastewater.
Cholera spreads through food or water contaminated with the bacteria that causes it. Several countries in southern Africa have experienced serious outbreaks of cholera over the last year that might have influenced the decisions by authorities in Mauritius, who say the situation required an overabundance of caution. Mauritius sits on the east coast off the east coast of Africa, past Madagascar, and is a popular tourist destination. One of the largest cities in North America is running low on water. Many of Mexico City's 21 million residents are wondering when their taps will stop turning on. Others are asking when their water will return. Reese Tisdale has been following the slow decline of Mexico City's water system. He is the president at Bluefield Research, a consulting firm focused on water markets. I asked him to describe how severe the water shortage is now.
It's incredibly bad when you think of the scale of how many people, you know, 22 million people in Mexico City, and the thoughts of day zero, which is effectively when there's not enough water supplies or supplies will be effectively cut off. If that's going to happen sometime this summer, then it's pretty incredible. And it's not just, you know, as W.H. Auden said at one point, you know, thousands have lived without love, but no one's lived without water. And that's the bottom line.
And so what is the situation in Mexico City right now? I know that some people have lost access to water, but not everyone.
Yeah, so there have been neighborhoods that have been cut off. I mean, Mexico City has been facing this challenge in the country as a whole. You know, they've had series of droughts for several years. Reservoirs don't catch up. They have aging infrastructure. So when they have leakage rates of 30, 40, 50% in different neighborhoods or across parts of the city, then people don't have access to water. It's because of the inefficiency of the system. They've been overdrawing the groundwater supplies and aquifers at a rapidly increasing rate. And so then that turns to trucking and other, what I would say, unsustainable temporary measures.
So Mexico City is experiencing this water shortage because of both aging and poor infrastructure and also climate or weather factors. Is that right?
100%. And just a massive population. I mean, we're talking one of the largest cities in the world, if not the largest.
So some experts have said that Mexico City could experience that day zero, a day with no water, in a matter of months. Mexico City's mayor was asked about the water shortage in a recent press conference and said this.
Está garantizado el servicio.
He's saying that the reports of an upcoming day zero are, quote, fake news spread by political opponents. Reese, if Mexico City were to run out of water eventually, what would that look like?
Well, I think it becomes potentially like a Berlin airlift moment of trucking in water and things of that nature, because people cannot survive multiple days without access to water. Now, there are things that happen. We've seen this happen in Cape Town, South Africa. We've seen it happen in Barcelona or in Melbourne, Australia, or Sao Paulo, Brazil, where the rains ultimately come, but it may only happen for a little while. And to be prepared for it, quite honestly, takes years, if not decades. It's not like you can flip on a dime and say, we have access to capital and we're going to install systems immediately. It all takes time.
Now, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador addressed the water problem in a press conference in January.
Y algo que es importantísimo, invertir en la reparación.
The president said new wells are being drilled and aging infrastructure is a big problem. He said the city loses about 40% of its supply to leaks. How much of this can be fixed with improved infrastructure?
Oh, I think it can be huge. For every, you know, gallon of water, 40% is just disappearing into the soil or in many cases being stolen as well, right? When people are desperate, they tap into pipes. And so that's another form of what we would call non-revenue water. I do think just drilling wells is also not the long-term solution either. There needs to be an improvement in leakage or reduction, should I say. There needs to be reuse of wastewater, so treating wastewater, reclaiming it, using it for other purposes as much as possible. Technology is not the issue. This happens all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Cape Town in South Africa came close to a day zero back in 2018. The crisis was averted after some rains returned. But it was a close call. Are there models of what Mexico City can follow to avert its own day zero that you would point to?
Well, I mean, one thing that's interesting, it's as far as location, it's in the middle of the country. It's not along the coast. So I think in Melbourne, where during the millennium drought, the government invested significantly into things like seawater desalination and reuse. And in fact, they built a desalination plant, and then it started raining again. And they didn't even need it for almost another 10 years until 2017 or 2018. That is one approach. In Cape Town, you know, they were saved. The reservoirs began to fill up again. I can't say that they have been fleet of foot as far as addressing the longer-term problem. I mean, they've made some steps towards, you know, small-scale desalination or reuse, but still, there are a lot of challenges in that case. As I'd mentioned, also, Barcelona is another, you know, they face critical droughts. And in fact, this happened over a decade ago where they're facing a drought. They've installed a desalination plant. But then they're also facing water stress once again this past summer, where they were looking to restrict water usage and sort of control the demand somewhat.
Rhys Tisdale is president of the water consulting firm Bluefield Research. He was briefing us on the water crisis facing Mexico City.
Camel racing, it's been a thing for a long time. There are records of races on the Arabian Peninsula that date back to the 7th century. It is still a very popular pastime with modern updates like robot jockeys and big cash prizes. But as Stacey Vanek-Smith reports from the UAE, a new team is taking camel racing back to its roots with a twist.
It's a clear, scorching hot day at the Al Mamoun Camel Racing Track. This is the largest camel racing track in the United Arab Emirates, located in the Al Mamoun Desert outside of Dubai. Just outside the main arena, dozens of people are gathered, chatting, fanning themselves, and posing for selfies with the racing camels.
Smile!
Look here. There's an ice cream truck nearby, attached to a big, noisy generator.
Thank you all for coming, ladies and gentlemen. I know it's a toasty day today.
The MC jumps out onto the steps of the arena.
This is the first race of the season. It's a fantastic thing because this is the first time women's camel racing has been a thing.
Women's camel racing. Although the crowd here is certainly smaller than the hundreds who show up for the regular races, the women's team has started to get some traction. A couple of news outlets are here. Jeep is sponsoring the event, along with a couple of local businesses.
And we have a new sponsor this year, Camelay, which is camel milk, high in calcium. We have some around. So please do try that. It's great to have them on board.
The race is being put on by the Arabian Desert Camel Riding Club, founded 3 years ago by a German expat.
My name is Linda Krockenberger. Krockenberger in English, maybe.
Krockenberger came to Dubai to work in the hospitality business. But after a touristy camel ride, she was hooked and wanted to take up racing. But for years, she struggled to find someone to train her. People told her the sport was not for women, suggested maybe she could try if she dressed as a man or rode at night. Eventually, Krockenberger found a willing trainer, and as soon as she got the hang of riding, she started giving lessons.
I felt that wasn't necessarily accessible to many others, so the school is a little bit a doorway for that.
Before she knew it, Krockenberger was running a riding school. Local women flocked to her camel riding club, tourists too. Krockenberger has also gotten a lot of support. The UAE has officially licensed her school, and a new branch of the club has just opened in Saudi Arabia. Still, Krockenberger says, there are some skeptics.
Oh, really? We need a German to teach us an Arabic tradition? Of course, these comments also do get to me because I don't want to impose myself. But in my head, I try and calm these thoughts by saying, well, if you're such a great teacher, there's nothing that stops you from teaching as well.
Krockenberger has studied the history of camel racing, and her club emphasizes the traditional ways. The women ride barefoot, they don't use saddles, just Bedouin blankets. The races look a lot like they would have centuries ago, with a few key differences.
There's two ways that you can watch the race. We can stand at the finish line, which you can walk to. The other way to watch is by car.
By car. While the racers lead their camels to the start line, a group of visitors jump into their cars and line up on a road beside the track. After a few minutes, they're off. The camels jerk forward and start barreling down the track. The cars speed alongside, people cheering and honking out the window. The camels gallop past at about 30 miles an hour. The riders, in their helmets, are perched on blankets, yelling and clutching the reins. Just a few minutes later, the race is over, and everyone rushes to the winner's circle. 27-year-old Rowan Sala won the race, her camel, Zafron.
What was it like when you crossed the finish line?
It felt great, honestly.
Sala is an engineer from Jordan. She's been racing camels for about a year, and today is her first win.
What is it like to race all women?
It feels empowering to have a ladies-only race. Like, it encourages more women, I think.
Women like Mazda Rashidi and Hiba Hatai, they both came today to see their first camel race.
Oh, what did you think?
It was amazing, very exciting. The fact that you have to follow the race and you are not just sitting, you know, and watching. You have to drive your car and watch the road and watch the camels.
Both plan to sign up for riding lessons. The racers gather to collect their prizes. For Rowan Sala, it's $1,000 and some free camel feed. Also the promise of another race in a couple weeks.
So thank you all for coming. Please give them a big round of applause.
For The World, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith, Al Maamoun, UAE.
Keeping control of a brittle system. Just ahead, the power structure around China's president, Xi Jinping. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Chinese government does not like surprises. When there's political intrigue or anything like an official shakeup, it almost always plays out behind closed doors. Take Qin Gang. He was China's foreign minister when he disappeared from public view last June. He hasn't been seen in public since.
And just today, he resigned as a member of the national legislature. Qin Gang's downfall was repeated when the Chinese defense minister and several high-ranking military officers were dismissed last fall. Isabel Hilton is a longtime China watcher and the founder of the nonprofit China Dialogue Trust. She talked me through the theories of what happened to Qin Gang, a one-time rising star in the party.
He was, you will recall, the ambassador to the United States. It is said while he was there that he had an extramarital affair and a child. I have to say, given the behavior of China's leadership, you wouldn't think that that in itself was going to be, you know, grounds for dismissal. That well-known and well-established tradition of having mistresses for men at the top of Chinese politics. The other theory that was much discussed was that there was a suspicion of espionage, a suspicion of leaking secrets. If that was the case, we're not going to see him again, and we would expect a rather brief trial to happen, probably 10 minutes long, when the party's ready, and then we won't see him ever again.
And what about the dismissal of the defense minister late last year, along with some top brass in the People's Liberation Army? A similar story? I mean, do you have any other scenarios there?
Yeah, similar story, but a few more clues as to what might be behind that. Xi Jinping has run an anti-corruption campaign for a good 10 years now. Corruption is absolutely endemic. There's no systemic reform which would deal with corruption. So it is a matter of moving against individuals. And some 5 million officials have been purged under Xi Jinping. What's unusual for Xi Jinping is that this has gone on for 10 years, and this really speaks to a kind of mindset which is quite worrying and increasingly paranoid. In the case of the defense minister, Li Shangfu, the belief is that when problems were discovered in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when the armed forces, you know, were found to be lacking tires and petrol and, you know, things were not working as they were meant to, that the Chinese armed forces came under closer inspection just in case something like that was going on. And millions have been spent modernizing the armed forces, which is a classic scenario in which money goes astray. So it is quite likely that Li Shangfu and the many other 7 or 8 other senior Rocket Force officials who have been purged were dipping into the funds.
Mm. I mean, as you know, the communication of political drama in China is tightly managed. Are you able to read between the lines of what these dismissals tell us about possible political friction between Xi and these dismissed individuals, friction beyond corruption?
What we're seeing, I mean, either people are plotting or the regime is paranoid. It's very hard to know which, but I sort of doubt people are plotting at this point. I do think that there is an increasing paranoia in the regime and an increasing uncertainty, which comes with the kind of fear that these purges generate. And also the fact that, you know, fear is an instrument of control in a system like that. And Xi Jinping has used it for many years. But it does have downsides. You maintain control, but you maintain control of an increasingly brittle system. And when you have other problems, as China does now, economic problems, you know, lots of difficulties which demand cooperation, and you need people to speak up and deal with these problems, then you're not very well equipped, simply because of the system you created.
Isabel, if it is paranoia, does that trickle down to the rank and file in government ministries? Like, with few clues as to why these individuals were dismissed, or even that they have been. I mean, how is this even spoken about in China among government workers?
It absolutely trickles down. And one of the big problems with taking out powerful people at the top of the tree is that they all have political dependents, if you like. They all have their patronage circles. They have people who they've worked with. And as soon as one of those goes down, one of the senior figures goes down, the entire circle comes under suspicion. Again, in a system like that, you have opportunists who know that one way to political advancement is to demonstrate your hyper-loyalty by denouncing others. And so you get a kind of paralysis in the system in which officials become extraordinarily reluctant to take any risk at all. And so there's a term in Chinese for it, which is called lying flat. And increasingly, people are simply sitting on their hands because to do anything else is too risky, it's too dangerous.
I'm curious about just the intensity of the purges right now, how that compares with the past, and are you expecting to see more dismissals like this?
I think certainly there will be more dismissals. Before Xi Jinping, we had anti-corruption drives. They were relatively short-lived. But there was a very early signal that Xi Jinping was going to use these anti-corruption drives rather more vigorously, shall we say. That was when he took down a former member of the Politburo, a man called Zhou Yongkang. And that happened around 2015, 2016. And Zhou Yongkang was a man who was in charge, or had been in charge, of the whole domestic security apparatus. He was a big figure in the oil business, and he was a member of the Standing Committee of the Politburo. You don't get much more powerful than that. So if someone like that can be taken down, and all his political dependents and cohorts and circles, it was a clear sign that Xi Jinping had made it unsafe to leave power, and that he himself therefore could not leave power. So, you know, you have then a very different regime, a regime that has to go on purging people and seeing plots everywhere, because it doesn't create security. The system does not create security either for the leader or for the party.
That is Isabel Hilton, the founder of the China Dialogue Trust nonprofit. She joined us from London.
Join us tomorrow on The World for a look at spyware. It can be secretly installed on smartphones to harvest personal information.
You start to think about what was on my phone. You know, what could they have potentially gained access to? That's a conversation that goes on in your head for a long time.
That's a human rights advocate in Jordan who says he was hacked by spyware. We'll hear his story and others tomorrow on the show.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you, as always, for listening.